Did I miss the 12 traditions? Like, there's 12 traditions sometime, right? Hi, my name is Prince Sale, an alcoholic. Wow, what a great group. I want to thank Trevor. Where did he go? Showed up for 3 seconds. Oh, there he is. It's like, hi, I'm here. Thank you, Trevor, for asking me, Christy, for asking me before. It's always an honor and a privilege to do this. It's funny, you know, when I got sober, nobody wanted to hear anything I had to say. So the fact that the people say, hey, come down and talk to me, it's like, okay, sure. Never know when they'll do that again. I want to welcome everybody who's new to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to the greatest experience of your life. I know it doesn't seem that way, but it will eventually. I didn't think that was what I was walking into, that's for sure. My sobriety date is February 1st, 1988. I was 18 years old when I got sober for the second time. And I came here really just to get my mother to calm down. Like, literally, that was the reason I came here, because she was screaming and yelling and ha unhappy and wanting to send me to, I don't know, boarding school in Saudi Arabia somewhere. I don't know. And she was just pissed all the time. And the only way I could get her to calm down was if I got sober. And so I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I never really wanted to be sober. I didn't know how to be drunk. I didn't know how to be sober. I didn't know how to live. You know, I've been obsessed with wanting to feel good since I was born. Like, that's all I've ever wanted, is to feel good. And I can get addicted to anything that makes me feel good, literally. Like, you know, you smiling at me could be an addiction. It's the thing. And so you know, I've just always wanted to feel good. And the thing is that my drinking eventually, I couldn't feel good enough for long enough. And I would wake up in strange places doing strange things with strange people. And the shame and the remorse and the guilt of, you know, what I had done or where I had been or the things that had happened to me, became more and more overwhelming as time went on, and I couldn't make them go away. Alcohol never stopped working. It always made something go away for at least 5 minutes. I just couldn't live and be drunk at the same time. I just couldn't, and I couldn't die. You know, it's a lot easier to die these days than it was back in the 80s. I know that sounds really weird. How many people were born after 1988? None of you? Okay, so I have pants older than some of you. So, you know, it was harder to die. People didn't die as often as they do now. You know, it's a very different situation. It was a very different situation. But I didn't want to be alive. I just couldn't. It just didn't happen to me. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. Doesn't make me an alcoholic, but it helped. My dad was an alcoholic. Also, doesn't make me an alcoholic, but it helped. You know, and he was the kind of alcoholic who, you know, everybody wanted to hang out with. He was a lot of fun. He worked in the music business. He was friends with a lot of really interesting people. He designed album covers. Some of you, I'm sure, know what those are. And some of you, and they don't have them really anymore. But he designed album covers, and so he was a lot of fun. He was creative. He was funny. You know, everybody loved my dad, but nobody loved him more than I did. And I loved being his daughter. Like, I was, you know, his favorite person to hang out with. I was his, you know, he was my hero. He was the love of my life. He was just everything to me. You know, we had a good time together. But when you grow up in a house like that, where, you know, drugs and alcohol and naked people are running around at any given moment, you know, you don't understand that there's anything wrong with that. Like, I grew up in that environment. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. Like, that was just normal for me. I thought you had drunk, naked musicians running around your house too. I had no idea. But that was just what it was like in my house. And so I don't really remember my first drink per se. I remember the first time I got drunk. I was 12. I know I waited so much longer than my husband, but I was 12. The first time I drank to get drunk. And I went to a party at my cousin's house, you know, older brothers, older cousins, you know, you've got to have somebody older to turn you on to something, right? And my cousin was graduating from high school, and she invited me to her house to go to this party with her and all her friends. And I went to this party, and I just remember who I was very distinctly before that night and who I became after that night. You know, and the kid I was before that night was somebody who was You know, and this is all in hindsight. Like, I didn't have these conscious of thoughts when I was 12 by any stretch of the imagination. This is looking back now, but like, I was uncomfortable, right? I was awkward. I was uncomfortable. I was taller than everybody else. I had bigger boobs than everybody else that I was friends with at the time. At the time. They haven't grown since, but that was at the time. And so I was uncomfortable in my skin. I was uncomfortable just being around, you know, just being me. I didn't know how to deal with the anxiety. I didn't know how to deal with, you know, the emotional immaturity. I didn't know what to do with all the feelings I was having. And I would pretend that nothing was happening. I just tried to be as cool as I could possibly be, but I was pretty sure you could see that I was on fire. And now, because that was how it felt. I felt like I was just on fire all the time. And my head was just racing all the time because I was obsessed with what you were thinking about me because I was convinced you were, right? you know, was I funny enough? Was I cute enough? Did my butt look cute in these jeans? Like, I was obsessed literally with what you were thinking about me. And I walked into this party and they were sitting around card tables playing quarters. And I had never played quarters and my life, but I walked in and sat down like I'd been playing all 12 years. And because that's a skill of an alcoholic, right? We can walk into any situation and adapt in a second. And I sat down and I started to drink. And, you know, that magic happened. That magic thing happened. Whereas as the alcohol started to go into my system, like all of that discomfort, all of that anxiety, all of that stuff just started to disappear. And it was, you know, that was magic for me. I had never felt that relaxed in my whole life. You know, the greatest part about that night was that for the first time in my life, all that chaos that was going on between my ears was gone. Like, it was just gone. I didn't care what you thought. I didn't care what I thought. I wasn't thinking, I'm pretty sure. And like, it was just magic for me. Did I become a daily drinker at 12? No, don't be obnoxious. But did I become obsessed from that point forward as to what do I have to do and where do I have to go and who do I have to be to get that to happen again? Absolutely. And I did. You know, I went from being this kid who was obsessed with being a prima ballerina and doing pretty good at school and only cared about my dad being in love with me to being this kid who was slipping out her window every night and getting in cabs in the middle of the valley, taking them to Hollywood and going clubbing every night and hanging out with the boys and doing drugs and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. And, you know, getting back at 4 o'clock in the morning so I could take a nap before I went to school. So, you know, that was just, it was a totally different life. And as I started to arrive, as my life started to get amazing, because I was hanging out with all the right people, as you know, because you were the right people as well. My dad's alcoholism got worse. And he ended up in rehab in 1981, which in 1981, it was super, super, super not cool to be an alcoholic. Like, so not cool to be an alcoholic. Like, today, if you're a musician or you work in the music business and you go to rehab, you literally leave with a record deal. Like, it's a whole different, whole different experience. And we, you know, we lost everything. We lost the house. We lost the friends. He lost the job. My parents got divorced. It was brutal. And my mom became obsessed with trying to get him sober. She was chasing him in and out of rehabs and in and out of meetings. And do we have any Al-Anons? Any? Oh my God, we don't even. Oh, we have one. Thank you, God. Oh, thank you. Okay, we're safe. We're safe. We just need one. We just need one Al-Anon. We're okay. But the Al-Anons finally got a hold of my mom and they sat her down and said, you know, we have meetings for you. there's a program for you. And so she started going to Al-Anon meetings, and then they said, yeah, we have meetings for your kids too. And I just remember her coming over to tell me that, you know, she was going to take me to this Alateen meeting, right, where I could go and sit and talk about what a hot mess my parents were and learn about alcoholism. And I'm thinking I'd rather stick a hot poker in my eye than go do that. But I lost that battle because I was 13. And I just remember thinking, like, if I have to go sit with these lame kids and listen to this lame crap for 6 minutes, even, like, I'll just get as loaded as I can handle, and that way I'm not really there, right? So I got as stoned as I could stand and got in the back of my mom's car, and we drove over the hill to Brentwood, over the hill to grandma's house. And I just remember the whole way there, I was like making plans in my head, right? Like, I'm not going to the stupid meeting, like, I will go for a walk, right? Like, I'll go sit in a bush, right? Like, I'll go rob a liquor store, I will go do anything, but I'm not going to this late meeting, right? And she pulls up in front of the church and there's all these kids out in front, you know, roughly my age. And I look out the window And I saw the most beautiful boy I have ever seen in my entire life. And I went to Alateen religiously for 7 years. And because this is a program of attraction rather than promotion. Yeah. We don't really care what attracts you. Just stay. And I did. We had a great time. Like, you know, we would go to meetings and go to dances and go to conventions. You know, my mom saw nothing wrong with putting her 13-year-old daughter on a train and sending me from LA to San Diego to go to the SoCal convention with a couple $100 in my pocket. She thought, oh, she's safe. She's going to an AA convention. She had no idea what room I was staying with, who I was staying with. Like, if she would have known that we had one hotel room and 16 teenagers in one hotel room, like the fact that I ended up drunk, butt naked, covered in shaving cream at an AA convention, like, shouldn't be shocking to anybody, right? Because what else would you do, right?
But that's
what my drinking looks like. Like, I don't know about you, but there's no such thing as like social drinking at 12. Like, that's not a thing, right? Like, from the second I started drinking, it was for the effect, right? I loved the effect produced by alcohol. I loved what it did for me more than I liked what it did to me, right? What it did for me was usually made me, I don't know, prettier, tittier, and wittier, usually is what it did, right? But what it did to me was I usually, you know, blacked out, I was violent, and I almost always woke up naked somewhere. Right. And that's, I mean, it's fun for other people to watch. It's not necessarily fun for you. Right. But I was willing to pay the price. Right. I was willing to pay whatever price was necessary to feel that relief, for even if it was 5 minutes, you know. And that was just how I drank. And I loved what it did. I can remember thinking, I'm going to just drink a little bit. Like, I just want to be tipsy. I don't want to be sloshed. Like, I just want to be tipsy. I don't even know how to spell tipsy. Like, I never got tipsy. I was tipsy just standing up, you know? And so I never knew how to do that. And I couldn't, you know, I'm that way with everything. You know, I'm addictive by nature. And literally, if it makes me feel good, I want more and I want more and I want more and I want more until I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. And that was my experience. You know, the first time that I blacked out and woke up in a place that I hadn't anticipated, I was like 15 and a half years old. I woke up in the alley across the street from Grumman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood and, you know, really had no clue on how I'd gotten there. And that's frightening. Like, for a 15-year-old, that's terrifying. It's not normal behavior for a 15-year-old, not normal behavior for a 40-year-old either, but it was definitely terrifying. And because I'd been around Alcoholics Anonymous and because I'd listened to you guys tell your stories, I started to recognize that, like, what was happening to me, right, was kind of some of the same stuff that was happening to you, right? And thank God for identification. Identification is a big deal here. And if we don't identify with each other, then, you know, we think, why am I here? I don't need to be here, right? We don't have to identify exactly, but, you know, just to relate on any level, it's so crucial for this to work. But I would hear you guys talk about your stories, and I really believed that alcoholism was about consequences. I didn't know what alcoholism was about. I thought that alcoholism was about drugs and alcohol, and if you just got rid of the drugs and the alcohol, that you'd be fine. I mean, and if that was true, you'd have a different speaker tonight, because the truth is, for me, when the drugs and alcohol are removed, it gets worse for me, not better. I become more insane. I become more out of control. I become more, you know, defective in the way that I solve problems. It doesn't get better for me. It gets worse. But I got sober at 15 and a half years old, and I believed that it was just a math equation of take the drugs and the alcohol away and everything will be fine. And I would go to meetings and I would sit in the back. And there was some speaker meeting on Sunday nights in Laguna. I used to go all the time, and it was a spiritual speaker. And I would stand in the back and just talk out the side of my neck through the entire meeting. Right. Because, again, like, you know, I'm not as bad as you guys. I mean, you guys are sick. I mean, I know how sick you are. You're really sick. But I'm not as bad as you. I just need to be sober, you know. And I was so arrogant and I was so young and so unwilling to do this anybody else's way or ask any kind of questions, because I didn't want to look bad, not realizing I was already looking bad, right? But anyway, I stayed sober for, I don't know, almost 2 years. And then I copped a resentment at somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Imagine that, right? Nobody does that anymore. Because that's the easiest thing to do. You know, I don't know about you, but I'm a case builder. Anybody else a case builder? Right? Yeah, I build a case. I'm going to build a case about why I'm right, about how wrong you are. So I don't have to change. I just have to get rid of you. Right? That's how I lived my life. That was my conflict resolution system forever. Because I'm always right about how wrong you are. Always. Like, I mean, just ask me, I'll tell you all about it, right? So I would sit around and do that. And instead of saying, God, what did I do wrong in this situation? What could I have done different? Those were not questions that ever crossed my mind, ever. But how could I build a case about why you are an idiot? I can do that in 2 seconds, right? And, you know, you start to build a case long enough, you start to say, oh my God, it's everybody in AA. Everybody in AA is an idiot. I've got to go, right? Like this place, you all are drama queens and gossip mongers. And, you know, I am too, but we're not talking about me. We're talking about you. And I got to go, you know? And I made a decision to leave Alcoholics Anonymous because I was like, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. I mean, you know, I was 15. How much of an alcoholic could I be, right? And, you know, and I was out and off to the races one more time. And, you know, how many of you have ever been sober and gone out? Yeah, I mean, it's common. It wasn't always common, but it is common. And I did, because I didn't understand what it meant to be sober. I really didn't I didn't understand it. But I went out and I was off to the races. And, you know, getting drunk was a lot harder the second time than it was the first time. The first time I didn't have all you happy, shiny AA people in my head going, oh, keep coming back. Oh, just pick up the phone when you want to drink. Oh, do this. I didn't have any of those people. But now I got to get all them drunk too. So now it's an event, right? And so like, there was just a lot happening in there. And, so it took a lot more for me to get drunk and I blacked out a lot more. I was blacked out almost the whole 6 months I was out there. And again, all kinds of things happened to me, all kinds of, you know, sexual assaults and all kinds of, you know, crazy fights and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff happened. And they were all prices I was willing to pay in order to not feel how I felt. I was willing to pay the price. But on February 1st of 1988, I woke up one more time, having been sexually assaulted, having had a party at my house, having been so blacked out, I don't even remember almost all of it, right? And I woke up on that day going, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this. And I said a prayer that I believe every alcoholic says at one point or another. And that prayer was, help me. And I'm not a prayer. Like I didn't grow up in a family that was religious in any way, shape, or form. Like I asked my father who God was when I was five. He said he was, like, that was the end of my spiritual upbringing. Like I had zero understanding of what a spiritual concept was. So for me to say those words into the universe or to whoever was a just pure evidence as to how beat up I really was. I detoxed in my room for a couple of days, and then my mom, being the beautiful, wonderful Al-Anon that she is, you know, broke my door down and said, hey, you need to go to a meeting. You need to get out of here. And I remember thinking, oh, no, no, not those people. Not again. Right? Because you guys are the problem. And I thought, well, I can't really stand myself, so I got to go do something. So I eventually ended up in a meeting. And somehow you guys all knew I was new. Not sure if it was the bikini top or the Daisy Dukes or the candies I was wearing, but y'all knew I was new and you were so nice to me. Oh my God, you remembered my name. You would give me cigarettes. You would take me to coffee. You would take me to, you know, dinner. You did all kinds of things. And I was lucky because I landed in a group of people that were roughly the same age as me, my husband, who was in that group of people. We did not like each other then. We were not friends then, but we were in the same group of people. I happened to land in that group. And, you know, they just grabbed onto me and dragged me from event to event to event to a meeting to meeting to meeting to, you know, they just grabbed me and dragged me everywhere. And thank God for that, because if I had to make the decision to, like, go hang out with you, I would be like, yeah, no, I'm good. Yeah, I'm going to watch whatever, right? But they just grabbed me and they would show up at my house and pick me up and put me in the car. And we'd go to meetings and dances and conventions and get really busy. And, you know, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope you have a group of friends that's doing that with you. I hope that all of you guys that are, you know, taking chips and, you know, welcome to all you newcomers and all you guys that celebrated, you know, milestones. Like, I hope you're all holding on to each other and just floating like an amoeba from thing to thing to thing, you know, because this A&A stuff, it takes a minute to sink in, right? Like it takes a while for this stuff to actually get a hold of you, right? So between now, when you're here, and when that stuff sinks in, we're hoping you'll just stay busy enough that you're okay with being uncomfortable. That's it, right? Like just, you know, they used to say, just hold on long enough till God kicks in, you know? And which I was never one of my favorite sayings, but it's true. Like it was just what would happen. And I was grateful for that, you know? I spent the first 12 and a half years of my sobriety doing Alcoholics Anonymous my way, because I came in here again, believing that this is just about drugs and alcohol. I can handle all the other situations, right? Romance, finance, and circumstance. I got that covered. Y'all don't need to help me there because I'm a master at ruining my life in those areas. So we're all good. I don't need anybody to help me do that. And I really believed that because I'd gotten sober, everything was fine, right? But I wasn't working a program. I wasn't reading the big book. I would get a sponsor. Like I'd hear some great speaker and I'd go up to her and be like, oh my God, will you be my sponsor? And they'd be like, yeah, of course. And they'd give me their, you know, their phone number. And then I never called. Like I had a whole box of phone numbers from women. It was fantastic. Like, but I don't know what you do with a sponsor, right? Like my relationships involve like, you know, hog ties and duct tape. Like I don't know how to have a relationship with anybody, especially a woman, right? And so I didn't know what you did with it. Like, what do you do? Dress it up, put it on your bed? Like, what do you do with a sponsor? So I had no idea. And if you're not in a group that has strong leadership and strong sponsorship and all those kinds of things, it's hard to figure that stuff out, right? And especially if you're as toxically insecure as I am, who is not willing to ask questions and not willing to say, hey, what does this mean, right? Because I don't want to look bad, not knowing that I already look bad, right? You know, I didn't find out. So I spent 12 and a half years in Alcoholics Anonymous doing this my way. And I pulled geographics in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I got sober on the West Side, went to a whole bunch of meetings, made a whole bunch of friends, got a whole bunch of commitments, right? Started making a whole bunch of decisions based on self that made you want to punch me in the face. And I started to build a case about why you guys suck, right? And I thought, it's these people on the West Side. I got to go. You people on the West Side, you're dumb. And the thing about getting sober in LA is you can cross a mountain range or a freeway and you'll never see those people ever again, right? Because nobody is driving to the valley to service a resentment. Nobody, right? Like that's not happening, okay? So I went to the West Valley, right? Started all over again, made a whole bunch of friends. I got a whole bunch of commitments, started making a whole bunch of decisions that made you want to punch me in the face, right? I started to build a case about why I should punch you in the face, right? And I'm like, oh, it's you people in the West Valley. You people in the West Valley, you guys are dumb. You're so dumb. I got to go. These are not my people, right? So I went from the West Valley, across the 405 to the East Valley. Whew, one more time, right? And, you know, did it all over again. Same dance, wash, rinse, and repeat, as my husband said. And you know, the problem was that when this time got dicey for me, I started to build a case not only against the people I was going to meetings with, but against people who were in Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, against alcohol. Like, this crap doesn't work. Like, I'm 12 and a half years sober, and you guys are bananas, right? And I don't want to be here anymore. And my life is no different today than it was when I got here, except I remember every horrible moment of it, right? That was the only thing that felt different. I was like, who cares, you know? And so I was a lot of fun to be around at that point. And I was dating a guy who I had met on the AA campus who was loaded out of his tree and had just gotten split up with his stripper wife. And he was like, do you still love me? I was like, of course I still love you. And he moved in because, yeah, that's the best I could come up with at 12 and a half years sober. Just move him in, right? And he's husband material. Move him in. And, you know, I learned a very, very valuable lesson almost. I did learn the lesson. I didn't take all the consequences. But, you know, they will take us out faster than we can bring them in. And his alcoholism was way stronger, way, way stronger than the amount of recovery I had at that moment. And I was playing with fire. I was literally playing with fire. He was dealing drugs out of my apartment. I didn't even know, right? And people in Alcoholics Anonymous now are walking away from me because I'm dangerous, right? And I'm angry. I'm like, are you kidding? You're judging me. Doesn't it say we don't judge? You know, you can turn this shit around on everybody, right? And psycho. And I had said, you know what, I'm going to go to one more meeting And if I don't hear something different, I'm so done with Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so done with you people. Like, if I don't hear something different, I'm done. And I went to this meeting because this woman, who apparently had been my sponsor for 3 years, she goes to this meeting, right? And I was, you know, you had to have somebody give you a cake every year. And, you know, I was only really going to the meeting because I was going to tell her I was leaving AA, right? And in case anybody was looking for me, so she would have an answer. And everybody cares. And I walked into this meeting and it was a big book study. Now, I don't know about you, but I never went to a big book study because, quite frankly, at the time, Hawkeyes didn't go to big book studies. So why would I go there, right? But I walked into this meeting and I sat down with my, you know, my arms crossed and my snarl on, right? And there was a crusty old timer at the front of the room reading 5 pages out of the big book. And it was a sniper meeting, right? The kind of meeting where they pick on you, like you don't raise your hands. They're like, yeah, you share, right? And I'm sitting there with all my glory, right? And he's like, oh, you happy pants, why don't you share? And I vomit all over this meeting about how much I hate you people and I don't want to be here and this crap sucks and blah, 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 right? Like, you know, I'm 13 years sober and I sound bananas. Like, you can't be any crazier than 13 years dry and just, oh, I was like, I was about to light on fire. I was so dry. And oh, it was bad. And at the end of the meeting, another old timer came up to me and he put his hand on my arm and he said, Quincy, he said, AA is full of sick people. He said, do not expect them to act well. And I didn't know if he was talking about you or if he was talking about me. In that moment. But he gave me a moment of grace, right? Because in that moment, what I got was, you don't have to get loaded to start over. You don't have to know everything. Just because you have time doesn't mean you have to have it all together, right? Where you have this unbelievable ego that makes us believe that, oh, well, I have this much time, so I should have my crap together. Or I, you know, I remember having 10 years sober and going, where's my husband? Why did everybody else get a husband? Like, you know, it's not like, they're not like dishing things out, at, you know, back of the line somewhere. So whatever. But he gave me a moment of grace in that moment. And I was so grateful for that, because for the first time in, I don't even know, I mean, probably forever, I actually felt like somebody heard me, somebody knew what I was talking about, and somebody said, it's okay, you're out of your mind, you're in the right place, right? And I needed that in that moment. The next person that walked up to me was the craziest, scariest person I've ever met in my entire life, because she was the kind of person whose whole deportment shouted that she had a real answer, and in case you haven't figured this out about me, I wasn't really looking for one, and she didn't care. She walked right through my force field and shoved her card in my hand. And she said, Quincy, she said, I'm really good at doing column work. And if you want help with those resentments, I can help you. First of all, I'm like, what resentments are you talking about? Like, what is she talking about? And I also had never had anybody say, I can help you. You know, I'm kind of a mouthy broad. I'm sure you figured that out about me, right? And one of my superpowers is I can be just mouthy enough to get you to come near me, but also to keep you away from me. Right? You want to come and hang out, but you don't want to touch the fire. Well, sometimes. But anyway, a whole other conversation. So she just walked right through my crap and she said, I can help you. And I was like, okay. So I called her and she said, Quincy, I just want you to write down who you're mad at and exactly why you're mad at them. And she said, and then come to my house when you're done. So I did, and I went to her house, and she said, bring your big book. Like, I had to search high and low for that thing because I had no clue where it was, right? But I found it. It was, like, yellow because it had never been opened. And, I went to her house, and she opened her big book, and hers was, like, all full of yellow highlighting and all kinds of notes. I was like, oh, I'm with the queen bee of big books. Like, I'm going to be all right, you know? And she explained to me how she was taken through the fourth step and how she was taught to do an inventory. And, you know, this is usually where I put my 30-second commercial in of there's absolutely no wrong way to do Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no wrong way to do this. There's not only one way to do this either, right? Everybody comes to Alcoholics Anonymous with a different level of willingness, a different level of education, a different level of understanding, a different level of everything. And whatever the journey is that we have to go on to get to the place that Alcoholics Anonymous promises us, which is freedom, that's just the journey we have to go on. So I don't care if you do that. I mean, the first time I went through the steps, they were on a wall in a clubhouse. So I had off the wall sobriety, right? So that was as good as I could do. You know, the second time I went through the steps, it was out of the 12 and 12, right? But the 12 and 12 doesn't actually have any directions. It's just stuff that explains the steps a little deeper, right? So that was the next way I did it. You know, but every time I went through the steps, it was a different experience. But when Linda took me through the inventory that day, she explained to me that she, the way she did it, there was 7 columns at the time, right? And, you know, and I've had people come up to me and go, 7 columns, the book doesn't say 7 columns. Please don't do that because I will yawn. But you know, it didn't matter. That was what she explained to me. And she showed me how she got that out of the big book as it was shown to her, you know? And you know, I don't care if you have 4 columns, 5 columns, 7, 100, like whatever. I don't care how many columns you have. If it gets you the freedom that Alcoholics Anonymous promises you, rock on, right? My only caveat to anything that I've just said is that if you didn't get the freedom that you were promised by going through the steps and going through the big book, just ask somebody else to take you through until you get there. Because honestly, the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous promises is freedom. That's it. That's all it's promising you is freedom. It's not promising you any, it's not promising you a husband, which I didn't know, right? I got 2. You're number 2. You're my favorite husband right now. And, I just see when you go away. you know, but it doesn't promise you a car, it doesn't promise you a house or a job or kids or not. It doesn't promise you anything, right? It just says, you know, if you want to get free of the bondage of self, then do this process, right? And that bondage of self that I live in on a regular basis is what stops me from having the life that I want. It's all it is. You know, alcoholism is really just self-sabotage. That's all it is, right? And it's strong. It is so strong, right? But if I don't learn how to identify it, it will own every area of my life, right? And so my whole journey on this whole thing has been learning how to deal with the way that I see the world and stop using the way I see the world as an excuse to not have the life that I want, you know? I asked Linda to be my sponsor. And she was so excited. She looked like she was going to eat me. And it was a little scary. She's like, oh, I would love to sponsor you. I was like, whoa. And whoa. She said, but I have some requirements. And I said, well, I have some requirements too. But you have no requirements. And I didn't say that because I'm not stupid. But she said, I need you to call me every day for the first 30 days. She said, so we can get to know each other, so you can get used to calling so that we can develop a relationship. I said, okay, that makes sense. She said, and then you need to call a minimum of once a week every, you know, from then after. And I said, okay. She said, I need you to go to at least 3 meetings a week. She said, anything less than 3 meetings a week. She said, you're a visitor in Alcoholics Anonymous, not a member. And I need you to be a member. And she said, and I need you to have commitments at those meetings. And one of those meetings needs to be a meeting that I go to. She said, because if I don't see you, I don't know you, I can't help you. I was like, okay, that makes sense. Right? She said, I have a sponsees meeting at my house once a month with all the people I sponsor. I remember thinking, oh God. And she said, I need you to show up for that. And I was like, okay. And she said, but this last one might kill you. Yay! Finally! I said, what is it? She said, well, Quincy, she said, it is a requirement of my sponsorship that whenever you're in front of the room, whether you are leading a meeting, you know, talking in a meeting, you know, secretary of meeting, taking a cake, whatever it is, she says, I require that you wear a skirt or a dress. And I remember thinking, where does it say that in the big book? Right. And today I know where it says it actually says it after the 9th step. It says, remember, it was agreed at the beginning that we would go to any lengths to stay sober. And I was like, oh, I didn't even own a dress. I had 1 dress. I was like, you know, I was a tore up jeans, hair on top of my head, no makeup, flip flops kind of girl. Like, I don't have a dress, right? And I remember thinking, oh, well, that's not a problem. Nobody's ever going to ask me to speak, so we're good, right? We're good. And then, you know, she took me through the big book page for page, word for word. She taught me how to identify my disease in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she taught me how to identify the solutions. And she said, Quincy, you need to know these things. She said, because there's going to come a time when you hate me. And she said, and you need to know that Alcoholics Anonymous works even if you hate me. And she said, because it does. She says, I will let you down. I will hurt your feelings. I will say shit you do not want to hear. And you're going to want to kill me. And I remember thinking, well, just don't do those things. And she said, but you need to know how to find the answers to your alcoholism, regardless of whether I'm in your life or not. You know, and I'm so grateful for that. So anyway, I get on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. Now all of a sudden I'm, you know, being asked to speak and I got to go buy dresses and I'm pissed because now I got to go spend money on dresses when I don't even like it. And of course, now I have a psycho obsession with dresses. So it's a problem. And we don't have to talk about that. And I start to go speak at meetings and I start to talk about, and my sponsor made me wear this dress and blah, 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 blah. Right. So I'm complaining. And she's sitting in the audience one of these times, right at the end of the meeting. She walks up to me and she was the kind of person that could just give you a look like she just whacked you on the back of the head without even moving. She was just like, right? And I was like, I could feel her hand on the back of my head. And she walks up to me and she goes, Quincy, she goes, do you not understand the dress thing? And I said, no, I don't understand the dress thing. She said, Quincy, she said, the easiest thing I'm ever going to ask you to do is to put your feet into a dress and zip it up. She said, that's the easiest thing I'm ever going to ask you to do. And she said, and if you're not willing to do that, she said, you're not going to be willing to do anything else. And she said, you're not going to waste my time. And she turned around and walked away. I never argued with her about that particular item ever again, right? Because that's the truth, right? How willing am I to be inconvenienced for my recovery? You know, how willing am I to do the stuff I don't want to do? I don't know about you, but my alcoholism shows up in only doing what I want to do. If I only do what I want to do, I get sicker. I become that crispy 13 year sober, crazy as a loon kind of person dating a loaded person, right? Like that's me at my best on my own, right? But when I become willing to do this somebody else's way, when I become willing to follow somebody else's suggestions, when I become willing to have a new experience in life and admit that my way of solving problems isn't necessarily the best way of solving problems because I can't see me objectively. I don't know about you, but I can see all of you perfectly, right? Like perfectly. I could tell you everything that's wrong with you right now, right? But I can't see me at all. I can't see the end of my nose. I can't see anything that's happening out of me at all. I can hear my voice. I can barely stand it, right? So I can't see me at all. So I need somebody who's in my life who's willing to tell me the truth about me so I can stop making a mess all over my life. Because I'm the last person to know what a mess I've made, right? And truthfully, she was willing to tell me the truth. She was willing to hurt my feelings often, and she did. She would say things to me like, Quincy, I care more about saving your life than I do about you liking me. Right, which made me trust her even more. I get the chills every time I remember that. And she did. She saved my life. She saved me from me. She taught me about my disease. She taught me about my solutions. She saved me from me. You know, the three things that saved my life the most was having a sponsor who told me the truth. That sponsor taking me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous so I could find the answers there and me being of service to all the people I've been of service to. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous believing I was broken. I thought I was broken. I thought I was broken, that I was never going to be fixed. And even when I was alcoholic and I was sober, I was like, I'm so ashamed of being alcoholic because that means there's something wrong with me. Right? But it has turned out to be the thing that is the most right with me. It's the thing that's most right about me. Is that me being alcoholic? There's no way I could have the life that I have today, have the husband, the relationship that we have, the kids that I have, the life that I've had, if I was not alcoholic. It has made me who I am so I can have the experience I was meant to have here, so that I could help the people I was meant to help. It is what is right about me. You know, if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, this can be a rough road, but it can also be the most incredible experience ever. I'm sober 575 years, and don't I look fantastic? I'm sober a long time, and every time I think, oh my God, not another year, right? Right? Like, I can't be this old, number one. I'm only 37, but like, I always think, you know, when do I arrive? And the truth is that I arrive every day. Every day I learn something new. Every day I have a new journey. Every day there is something for me to learn. You know, one of my favorite quotes right now is a thing that I saw recently, which was, if you don't feed your mind, it will devour itself, right? We don't just do this once and we're good, right? We're good, we're solved, we're fixed, right? This is something I do all the time with people I sponsor, with my sponsor, whatever it is. Every conversation I have somehow, some way incorporates all of the ideas and the principles that Alcoholics Anonymous taught me over the last 40 years, right? And so I'm grateful for that. And I know that that doesn't sound like a whole hell of a lot when you first get sober, but I have to tell you, I would much rather be me. I would much rather be an alcoholic who is dealing with a spiritual condition than be somebody who's not, because we all know those people too. You know, Linda told me three things that were pretty amazing that I still live by on a daily basis. She said, She said, Quincy, number one, you're responsible for your happiness. She said, if you're not happy, she said, it ain't about anybody else but you. She said, they're just a mirror that is showing up in your life that says, hey, you need to look at this, right? When I get angry at you, when I'm resentful at you, when I'm irritated by you, it's the universe's way of saying, this is something you need to work on, right? That person's never going to change. That person's never going to not be who they are, right? But it's not about them. It's about me. And what am I believing? And what am I seeing? And what am I, what's the story I'm telling myself that needs to change? And she said, so if you want to be happy, joyous, and free, she said, you better get your butt in here and do the column so we can figure out what's going on so we can get you back there, right? She said, you're also responsible for your recovery. She said, I may be your sponsor. She said, but if you want what I have, you better chase me like I owe you money. And so I did. I went everywhere she went. I went to all the meetings she went to. I went to hear her speak. I called her all the time, right? And we've all been this sponsee, right, where we call our sponsor and check in, right? How many of you all check in? Oh, hey, I'm just calling to check in. Hey, spots, I'm just calling to check in. Oh, hey, spots, I'm just calling, right? And I would call and go, hey, it's Quincy, blah, 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 just calling to check in. She'd go, okay, and she'd hang up on me. And I was like, oh, she's having a bad day, right? Because, of course, it's about her. It's not about me, right? I'm like, oh, she's having a bad day. I'll just call her tomorrow. Right? So I call her next day. Hey, Linda, it's Quincy. Just calling to check in. Okay. And she'd hang up on me again. I was like, oh, this is not good. This cannot be good news, right? And I, of course, talked to every person she sponsors before I talked to her to, you know, to see if she told everybody how much she hates me, which they had not, but I'm psycho. And they were all like, just call her, ask her if she doesn't like you. I'm like, what if she says I don't like you? I'm like, how do you respond to that? I say, because when people say that to me, usually I just punch them in the face. She's like, just call her. And I was like, fine. So I called her and I said, you know, Linda, do you not like me? She goes, oh, no, Quincy. She goes, I like you just fine. She said, but I don't want what you have. She said, I don't want what you have. I didn't ask you to sponsor me. She said, if you want what I have, she said, how do you think you're going to get it by calling me and checking in? I didn't ask you what's up. She said, you just start talking about yourself. You know, she said, if you want what I have, you better call and ask questions. I go, well, what if I don't have any? She said, make some up. She said, pull one out of the big book. There's practically a question on every page of the big book. Just pull one out of the big book. And I was like, okay, right? We got off the phone. 3 weeks later, she called me. She says, hey, I thought we covered this. You're supposed to call every week with a question. What happened? I said, well, I didn't have a question. She said, Quincy, she said, seriously, you don't have a question? And I said, no, I don't have a question. She said, Quincy, just ask me something, even if you already know the answer. I said, okay, what should I ask you? She goes, oh my God, you asked a question. Fantastic, right? And she said, because if you ask me a question, then I can participate in the conversation. She said, but if you don't ask me questions, then you're just talking at me and I don't care. I don't have time for that, right? She said, you want what I have, ask me a question. And I have to tell you, that one thing changed my life probably just as much as the dress thing did. Right? Because it was the one thing that I was so terrified to know how to do, which was ask questions. Because I'm afraid of looking bad. I'm afraid of looking stupid. I'm afraid of not knowing. I'm afraid of what you're going to think of me if I ask the wrong question. I got all kinds of crazy fears going on, right? The last thing she said to me, one of the last things she said to me was, she said, Quincy, she said, you are also responsible for carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. She goes, nobody cares what you do for a living, how many kids you have, how many dogs live in your butt. Like, nobody cares. Right? She says, all anybody really cares about is whether or not, you know, you've practiced the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you've gone on this journey and have experienced freedom and whether or not you know how to carry that message. That's all anybody cares about. So hopefully that's what I just did. Thanks.
Let's thank our speaker, Quincy, again.